One day I need to do a poll amongst the BizNews tribe on who their favorites are. And I can assure you that Professor Tim Noakes will be in the top three. Rob Herzhoff's got to be there. Neil De Beer's got to be there. But Tim, we don't talk to him as often, but it's a real privilege to be catching up with him again today. Now, I know, given your very busy schedule, Tim, we had to schedule this quite a way in advance, but it's so appropriate because there's a young man who's exactly half your age. He turned 38 in June, called Roman Kabanak, who I interviewed yesterday, who has been through the mill. He's a disruptor just like you are. Your challenges with the establishment are well documented. He's really had a tough time now. So for the next 38 years until he gets to your age, what is your advice to him?
The only thing that matters is the truth, Alec. That's what keeps you going. You know? And as long as you are trying to find the truth, you'll never regret it. And no one will be able to say you were a fake or a fraud. I think that's the key. It's tough, but in the end, you know, I'm rewriting my book, Law of Running, and as you know, I've gone to a completely different interpretation of physiology. And it's marvelous. It's wonderful because I can say, well, this is what I wrote there was untrue. It's wrong. And now we know better. And I can, and when I die, I know that what I wrote was the truth at the point when I wrote it. And I don't have a 100-year legacy of being wrong. So he must just keep doing what is right. And does the world ever catch up with what we're doing is right? I don't know, but maybe it's not material. We just got to face and fight for the truth.
I've visited your offices in Cape Town and had a look at that amazing library that you've got. You clearly put a very high store on reading. Do you still read a lot?
Yeah, and don't get a false idea because behind me you can see I've removed a lot of books because I have another library somewhere else where I've donated a lot of the stuff to that. So I read a lot and I continue to read everything possible. So for the last 4 years, I've been working on the next phase in understanding human carbohydrate metabolism. And we uncovered stuff by reading the history of the field from 100 years ago. We finally found out what's actually happening. And it was only by consistently reading and then seeing something. You see a trend and then you say, but that's happened again and that's happened again and no one noticed it. So that's how you find out what's meaningful. So we did some unbelievable research in the 1990s. It's unbelievable because we didn't know how good it was then. Because we misinterpreted it. We just saw it from the eyes of carbs are good for you, and this is what we're proving, when in fact we were showing something else. But only now, when you look back, you say, oh my gosh, that study was amazing. And I don't know why we stopped. Well, I know why we stopped, because actually it wasn't quite telling us what we wanted. So we stopped it. But then when you go back, you say exactly what it was showing you. It was showing you had to change your ideas. But now I can go back 30 years later and say, well, this is what it should have shown us. But now it does show that. We're currently, a paper is being reviewed by one of the top journals in the world, and it's 100 pages. Now, they only normally allow 50 pages in the article. And they said, no, we can't cut a word out of this article. It's too important. So, because it's a revolution. They said it's a paradigm shift, complete paradigm shift. So what's been taught in the exercise science since 1967, what was taught from 1939 to 1967 was correct. Then it got thrown out by one experiment, which wasn't proof. It didn't provide proof. And now 2025, 50 odd years later, we're being able to say what was said in 1939 is correct and what was said in 67 is wrong. And that's the change, because it has huge implications for health and what we teach athletes, how they should conduct themselves.
But it's not just athletes who have followed your advice. The low-carb, high-fat diet is now pretty well known. Somebody wants to lose weight. Many of the people of my acquaintance, they'll say, oh, I just got to cut out carbs, which wasn't something before Banting and Tim Noakes.
Yeah. Let's rephrase it. Humans are humans because we run. You know, that's the one defining characteristic that defines humans. We say we're tool makers or this, that, and the other, but actually there are other primates that also use tools, but we run. And that's the defining difference. And we run largely because we started eating animal proteins and animal fats. And that allowed us to change our whole biology, our whole skeletal structure to where we could start running. So if you watch a gorilla or a chimpanzee, they can sort of stumble along, but they can't run for any length of time. And that's what differentiates us, is our ability to run. And that all became because we changed our diet to eat animal produce, which we were doing very well on that until the 1970s, when suddenly the scientists said, no, you must eat carbs, not animal protein, animal fat. And that's when things changed. And we haven't looked, as a species, we haven't been looking good since the 1970s. Obesity rates going up, diabetes rates going up, and life expectancy dropping in the United States, for example, dropping quite substantially, despite spending more on medicine than any other country. So that's where we are today, and we just moved away from what we're designed to eat.
Now, I know you never step back from controversial areas, but something that occurred to me when I was thinking about talking with you today is that there's some very interesting parallels here between what's going on in South Africa right now with the economy. That's my area, if you like, some understanding, where we have this BEE that's been imposed on the economy, which is very, very largely responsible for stagnation for the last 17 years. And that 17 years, it's happened. We've grown at lower than our population growth rate. We really are going backwards at a rate of knots, yet the government is doubling down on BEE. Now I come over to what's happening on the health side. Obesity rates have been rising very rapidly. You'll give us the exact number, but the figures that I see are 30% plus. We have diabetes that is exceeding, and things that should never be happening, like finding fat disease in 8-year-olds, is now coming to the fore. So is there a similar thing here, that those who are benefiting this from the status quo are doubling down by attacking people like Tim Noakes, who said, hey, hang on, our research is showing something different, in the same way as we're seeing from an economic perspective, where it's almost like the ANC's got just one tune and they are not going to stop playing it?
Yeah. So I can explain it on the medical side. It's very simple. And I'm not an economist and I'm not a politician. So I can explain that side, and I'll leave you to draw your conclusions. If you ask me, I'll probably tell you what I think. I think merit is everything. And if you exclude merit, you're in trouble. And that's what BEE does. But also this, the move towards wokeness is a disaster. And I see it in my own university. That's when I went there in the 1960s, 1970s, you know, the selection was on merit. I'm talking now about the professors, and now it's not. It's if you don't have a particular political position, you're never going to be selected. And I was essentially moved out because I challenged those opinions. And I was merit-based, and they threw me out, even though I was one of the most meritorious professors they've ever had at the university. And they threw me out as a quack. It was astonishing. And that's where I see the problem from that side. But let's get back to health. So the pharmaceutical industry is the problem because they have to have us sick to sell their products to us. So that diabetes is a marvelous disease because the patient gets sick and they're just going to get progressively sicker until they die. And the cost to the pharmaceutical industry is huge. I mean, sorry, the opportunity for making money is enormous. And in South Africa, we have 10,000 new cases of diabetes every month, 10,000, and for a preventable disease. It's a preventable disease. And we know what the cause is and we know how to prevent it, but that means changing the whole food system. And the food system is also based on getting people addicted to these foods, which are low quality, high carbohydrate, high grains, and they cause then all the problems. So how do you address it? Well, you have to change the way the South Africans eat. And what is really interesting is that with the new government in the United States, and Kennedy has become the head of health and nutrition, I mean, he's waging war on the pharmaceutical companies, the vaccine companies, and on the food industry. And he's the first person in the world who's really trying to do something. And that's what you need. You need someone like that who's going to be given the right to change what we're eating and the way medicine is practiced. And the problem in medicine is when I was trained in medicine, we were taught this patient came to see you today. You must find out why they came to see you today and what's the cause of the problem. Because there are the two components. People wait before they come and see you, but then there's a long-term issue of causing their health, ill health. Today, you're not taught that. Today, you're taught this is the diagnosis, which you don't get that from examining the patient and talking, take an x-ray or blood test, and that now gives you the result. And you just check the textbook and says, well, for this disease, you prescribe those drugs. And it's nothing outside of drugs. You can't do anything beside the drugs. And so the really effective drugs, for example, in cancer, we're now realizing all there's a whole range of drugs that are incredibly effective in cancer, but you're not allowed to prescribe them. And you tend to be discouraged from using them. And that's not how you can save people. You've got to go and look at all the evidence. It doesn't matter where it comes from. Look at the evidence and then act on that. So that's what's happened in medicine. We've gone away from merit-based education. And we're being controlled by forces who don't want people to be healthy because there's no financial reward for them to make people healthy.
Sure. There's a lot in there, and I'm not surprised that you are regarded as a polarizing force in certain respects. When you just examine that a little more deeply, for instance, Discovery, and I know they loved you at one point. I don't know if they still love you, but they didn't love you for a while. Maybe they're loving you again. But Discovery have got a huge incentive for people to be healthy, and their whole business model is based on that. And yet they do.
I don't agree. Mm-hmm. Tell me why. Why do you think that?
Well, if I'm healthy, then I'm going to take less of their resources from their medical aid, and they're going to make more profit. Surely.
Well, you're excluding possibilities that there are other ways that they're making money. And I don't. You know, listen. I'm talking completely. From the outside, but that's the only way you could explain why not making people healthy is financially remunerative. There must be some other source of money coming in that is compensating for that. That's all I can say. I don't know, because you're quite right. I mean, diabetes is an incredibly expensive disease. But yeah, and we know how to prevent it. But does Discovery do anything about it? Not a thing. Not a thing. They just tell you to keep doing exactly what caused the diabetes. You continue to do it. And you take the insulin, which makes things worse. We know that. We know that treating diabetes the conventional way does not reverse the disease. And it just prolongs the life a little bit. And people use up their medical finances to keep them going. So I don't know. You know, it doesn't make sense. And if something doesn't make sense, you have to ask, why doesn't it make sense? Why did Discovery not go out and say, we were wrong? Telling you to eat a grain-based diet is wrong. You know, I got kicked out there because I read an article in their Discovery magazine called Against the Grains. And that was it. That was the end. I was never asked again, and I lost my funding. So you have to ask, why did they kick me out? Because I went against the grains. What is it in the grain industry that allows them to continue making money? And that's, and I don't know. And you see, you've asked the question. If eating grains makes you sick, why do they promote it? I don't know.
Yo, there are so many big questions which are now coming to the fore, and because we've got so much information. And I think that's really one of the big breakthroughs for societies, is that we can question these things, and you do have a voice. And there was a time, and I don't want to get banned from YouTube and COVID-19 and all of that stuff. Let's just put that one side. But the reality was, at one stage, because you were questioning, your voice was censored. It seems like that's out of fashion now, thank heavens. And that somebody else owns X, right. Thank heavens. Are you as active now on X as you were on Twitter before you weren't allowed to be active there?
Yeah, no, I'm probably more active now, and on a wider range of topics. And so, kind of nutrition is not one of them. Health is definitely one. The medical profession is one. Vaccines. I was one of the first to say the vaccines don't work and they're harmful and there's no evidence for benefit. And I was castigated for that. The media took me out, tried to take me out again. And now when you go back, the one professor from Wits said I needed to go back to UCT and ask them for my money back because I knew so little. So since then, I've written the foreword to a book called The Final Pandemic, The Final Epidemic, sorry. And it's written by a lady called Sam Bailey and her husband. And Sam's gone through exactly what I went through, a medical doctor, except she was practicing medicine. So she was excommunicated by the New Zealand Medical Board and she couldn't practice. I'd never had that problem because I was drawing a salary from the university. So even if I was kicked out, it didn't matter because I was still employed. And then I was anyway retiring. So she was kicked out and she's been charged $250,000 for running a website and doing YouTube. And she's brilliant. You just need to watch her, Sam Bailey. So she was a co-author of a book called Virus Mania, which it looks at everything about vaccines, going back to the right to the start, to Jenner and smallpox vaccines, and looking at all the fraud. And the fraud is unbelievable. And the pseudoscience is, it's unbelievable. So I said to her, you know, Sam, this is a fantastic book, but it's too big and it's too long and it's too intense. You need to take out the real material and put it out there in a shortened version. So she did. And then she really shocked me and frightened me because she said, well, you must write the foreword. Now, I didn't know whether she was right or wrong. And now I'm at risk. What do I do? Do I say this book is wrong or do I say the book's right? So I read it very, very carefully and I realized she's right. She says vaccinology is a pseudoscience and she gives the evidence. So that's, now why is that important? It's important because university in this country, medical schools run on the excess money they get from their research. So they take 20% of the income, goes to run the medical faculty from the research. And I know that because, you know, I raised a lot of money for UCT. And so that was the money that was going to the faculty. And that 20%, the more the research they can do, the more excess money they get to give the nice little add-ons in medical training. And it's crucial. Now, the lowest hanging fruits are vaccinology. That's no question. That's the easiest way to make money. And USAID was one of them, the National Institute of Health, and then Bill Gates. And that money just came flooding in, and it wasn't measured in millions of rands. It was measured in billions of rands. Now what happens is that money has disappeared, and the impact on the medical schools will be horrendous. I know that UCT is reporting they're going to have a million rand deficit this year, but they estimate it's going to be a billion rand over the next 4 or 5 years. That's because these low fruit, hanging fruits have disappeared. And the impact on medicine in South Africa will be huge, but it might make the profession more honest. So that just gives you an idea of what control there is on the teaching of medicine and why I had to be, you couldn't say anything about the vaccines because you were threatening this whole thing. And people need to understand that they blame Musk. So USAID, that's not USAID, it's USAID. It was a complete money laundering system. And it was just unbelievable how much money was disappearing in all sorts of places. And unfortunately, now there are patients in South Africa who would have been getting medication paid for by USAID, and they're not going to get it. But you can't blame the US government for that. The US government is bankrupt. And they've got to now find out why did they go bankrupt and where was all this money going? I mean, a simple example was who paid for Hillary Clinton's daughter's wedding? It was USAID. Who paid for her house, her mansion, her $80 million house paid by USAID and her wedding dress paid by USAID? I mean, that's how unbelievable it was. So what South Africans are saying, oh, you see, it's all Trump and it's all Musk. No. We should have been paying for our own HIV drugs, not expecting America to do it for us. And the fact that it was a money laundering system, well, we shouldn't want to be involved in that.
But yeah. It's so interesting when you dig a little deeper, dig beneath the surface. But Tim, just getting back to the US and RFK, Robert Kennedy Jr., and his appointment there, if you unpack that, how big an impact will that have on health in the United States? And here in particular, I understand that he has been targeting the pharmaceutical companies who have been spending a lot of money on advertising, and as a result, parts of the media are beholden to them. Just unpack all of that for us, because I have some disquiet about the political, big politics, big media cabal in this country as well, after listening to Roman Kabanek yesterday and then reading Tony Leon's book, which kind of, you know, lays it out. Not I think that he wanted to, but if you just read that book, it's quite scary how much these guys are working together. So let's just look at the US and what RFK will change.
So the problem in the US, and I suspect it's the same in South Africa, is 70% of the money funding the mainstream media comes from the pharmaceutical industry and adverts. So that's it. So the pharmaceutical industry determines what you hear on mainstream media, on television and in the media. And it's very clear the same happens here. And what he's doing is trying to reduce the income to the pharmaceutical industry, perhaps even to bankrupt it, because they are so dependent on vaccines. And if he proves that there's not a single vaccine that has ever been proven to be safe and effective, then things really will change. So I think that's the focus. He's the bravest politician. He's not really a politician, but he's the bravest man I know, because he's taking on the biggest interests that you can possibly want to attack. So I think that he is the last hope we have for medicine. He's really, honestly, is the last hope. Because if he doesn't succeed, then nothing's changing and people will just get progressively sicker. And the pharmaceutical industry will simply steal more of our money, taxpayers' money, and make us even more unhealthy and control more of what we teach to our medical doctors.
Extraordinary. But what about when you talk about vaccines? What about measles? That's often used as an example of a vaccine that worked, or polio, for instance.
Yeah, well, you have to go back to the history of polio, and you find out the first polio vaccine caused more deaths. It's called the Cutter experiment, and it went completely wrong and caused a huge number of deaths. And all those those pictures of the iron lung, those were largely vaccinated people. So that's what they were treating. They were treating a vaccine-induced illness. Polio is quite simple. It was caused by a DDT and some other chemicals which were being sprayed in America to stop for certain things. I mean, in the 1950s, if you went to the beach in Los Angeles, you could get sprayed with DDT. That's how bad it was. There are pictures of that happening. And then all of a sudden, when they stopped the DDT, then polio cases disappeared again. So, and DDT will produce exactly the same pathological changes in the spinal cord that polio causes. And what they've done is they've changed the diagnostic criteria. And so instead of calling it polio, what they see now, they call something different. Last year, I think there were four deaths from measles in the United States. There were hundreds of thousands of deaths from diabetes. Do you ever hear them talking about preventing diabetes? That tells you the whole story. You don't need one other fact to know that this thing is whole, it's fraudulent. And measles, when measles does affect you, it's in people who are have poor nutrition, they're vitamin A deficient, and what you need is nutrition. That's another key that we need to talk about. Many of the chronic infectious diseases occur in people when they are most malnourished. And we don't hear that. We don't hear about treating TB with proper nutrition or treating measles by preventing measles by appropriate treatment. Or tuberculosis. You know, you live in Hermanus. How many cases of tuberculosis are there in Hermanus? I can tell you, probably zero. Just travel outside into the communities where they've got poor nutrition, and then they say it's all contagion. Well, the funny thing is that in the TB hospitals in England, the famous Brompton Hospital, they had zero cases of transmission to the nursing staff over 50 years or so. Zero transmission from people who are exposed to people with tuberculosis every single day. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but if it were so contagious, why do the doctors and the nurses not get tuberculosis working in the TB hospitals? But we don't ask that question. And the answer is because they're better nourished. And so, you know, if I was in charge of medicine in South Africa, I would say we address nutrition. That's the first thing we do. And we start from day one, you know, when children are born. In fact, you even start before that because you want the nutrition of the mother to be improved. And that would do an enormous amount for us. Instead, we've got this high carbohydrate, high maize-based diet for the vast majority of people. And it's not, you can't live and work on that type of diet.
Tim, just to close off with earlier on, and you're doing so much on nutrition, and I would strongly advise that people go and have a look at the Noakes Foundation and the work that you're doing there, because it really is. You know, often people say, well, but people can complain. Well, you're not a complainer. You are a doer. But you mentioned earlier about cancer, that there are things that will work, that evidence is showing can work or is working for cancer. And we know that this is many, many people are suffering with this disease. They don't know any better. So they'll be just popping along to their oncologist and they'll be given what that oncologist is going to prescribe. What, if they came to you, would you be suggesting?
Well, a lot of people do come to me. And so, you know, it's because they're tired. So I'm not suggesting you don't follow the standard procedures. That's, you know, I always get accused, oh, you're just trying to get people away from that. No. I'm talking about things you can do in addition to what, or if you decide you can choose something different. But I'm literally every day on Twitter, there's a case report of a person who was given the last rites. And they take fenbendazole, mebendazole, and ivermectin. And they suddenly cure. They go from stage 4 disease to cure. And of course, these are anecdotes, but anecdotes are important and they need to be considered. So I refer them to a guy called William Makis, M-A-K-I-S. He's a physician in America who's got the Makis protocol, M-A-K-I-S protocol. And there are other protocols that people are using, and they're not just those three drugs. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that you can do. And, you know, I'm always reminded of Bruce Fordyce when he said, you know, Tim, you used to tell me I had a carbohydrate load, and then I would do this, and I would do everything like you told me, and I would never drop anything because I didn't know if I dropped one thing would be that the one thing that really worked. And well, of course, the whole thing was wrong. But anyway, but the point is, the people are being suggested to you do a lot of different things, and we don't know which of them is important and the most important. But they're all benign. They don't harm you. That's the key. Whereas chemotherapy is highly dangerous, toxic for many patients. And there's another great doctor, South African doctor in America, and I'll get his name in a second. And he frequently said, he was one of the first, this guy who's, again, I'll get his name. He worked at the Cleveland Clinic, one of the top clinics in America. And he was the expert in treating acute emergency cases. So when you came to the hospital and you were really desperately sick, he was the guy. And he was the second most published person in the world in that field. He was one of the first to come and say, we have to use hydroxychloroquine and we have to use ivermectin in COVID. And he was kicked out of his hospital. He lost his job at the hospital. Now, he has moved on, and he's got 10 things you need to do if you have cancer. And again, as I say, we don't know which of the 10 is the most important. But he said that the survival rates from conventional treatment of cancer are poor, very poor. And it's expensive, and there may be different options, and we should consider those options. So if I tell everyone who phones me, I say, please look at these people, look at William Makers, go and look at these other protocols. And it might mean you have to take vitamin C intravenously. It may mean you have to do oxygen therapy. It may mean you have to do all sorts of things. But it's worth the effort, and not just to stick to the conventional treatment, because we know the conventional approach is helpful for some, but for the majority, it doesn't cure you of the disease. And it gives you a very poor quality of life. That's very important. One of the people, the doctors that I do tell people to go to, he says, you know, I don't cure you of cancer, but I give you a better quality of life and an extended period that you can live, and your quality of life will be better. And I've watched not direct family members, but others dying from cancer, and it's getting conventional treatment. It's not good to watch.
Well, your own story, as you have discussed with us in the past, what put you onto the diabetes focus was your father's very painful death.
That's
and,
correct.
And you yourself getting it. But just I have to follow up there with Oskar Chalupski. He's a sportsman. He was at our conference in March. I got to spend a bit of time with him. I see on his WhatsApp or Twitter feed that he's just won a big golf tournament. And this is the guy who was given the last rites, years ago. Has he spoken with you?
Oh, yes. I see him regularly. When the last time I visited him, he was in hospital here locally for a week getting therapy. And I mean, he's amazing. And he's someone who has survived because of conventional treatment. He does absolutely everything. You know, everything, the 10 things that we might talk about. But he also uses the cutting edge medical treatments. And he said to me, and I'm sure he won't mind me repeating it, he said, what I do is I keep alive on a particular drug trial until I can find the next drug trial. And I get onto that drug trial. And it's worked. It's working for him. I mean, he said something like, I'm in remission. I'm not convinced about that, but because I've seen, he was one of the first people, I was one of the first people he spoke to when he got the original diagnosis. And we had a long meeting about it. And I've been very supportive, and we did gym together. And he's so competitive. It was just a gym, but he had to make sure that he was winning in the gym. So I have a long friendship. I owe a lot to Oskar. So I think I must tell you the one story, which was, you know, observations and anecdotes are so important, because in the 1983 it was, he was paddling from the race from Port Elizabeth to East London. It was called the Texan Challenge. That was a cigarette manufacturer. And we decided to do a study. We were asked to do a study on the guys paddling. And on the day before the opening event, the first day's paddling, he got up, and I promise you, 18-year-old, he got up in front of everyone and said, "You guys are all paddling for second. I'm going to win this race." So, so on the final day, which was a really tough day, they had huge breakers coming in. So they had to get through the breakers to get out into the sea. And as he went through, he lost his water bottles, were thrown off the boat, and they washed away. So he's paddled for 5 hours, and he couldn't drink any water. Now, at that time, it was said, if you became dehydrated, you'd die of heat stroke, you see. So we were fortunately, all we had, equipment we had was a measuring. We could have had a scale, and we had a rectal temperature thermometer, because that's all we could afford in those days. And so we decided to see, was there a link between the dehydration and the rectal temperature. So he came out of the water, and the first thing we did, we measured his rectal temperature and weighed him. And he'd lost 5 kilograms weight, you see. So I thought, 5 kilograms, he's going to be dead. His rectal temperature is going to be through the roof. And it was absolutely 37.8, which is absolutely normal. And the reason was, of course, because it's quite cold when you're paddling, the air movement, et cetera. It's pretty chilly down there. And so then we realized this is fake. This fluid balance got nothing to do with heat balance. And then we went out and researched it and proved that that's the case. So, but Oscar he's amazing. And I go to bed every night and I say, God, please put him in remission, because if he went into remission, that would be just phenomenal. I mean, I've seen the bone marrow things, and I thought, well, you know, you've got weeks to live, and somehow he gets past that every time. And I just hope it keeps happening like that.
So he's on those drug trials, but is he also using alternatives?
Absolutely. He uses everything. Yeah, he uses a low-carb diet for a start. He uses ivermectin, and then he uses a whole lot of other supplements. And he's religious about it. And so every day he's taking buckets of additional supplements and so on.
Well, I'm going to add him to my prayers as well, because he is such a wonderful inspiration for so many. And the second thing I wanted to ask you about is, I visited Babylon's Touring, and on a tour from the guide, I was very lucky, he used to be, I think, the head of Kirsten Bosch, and he's now the head botanist at Babylon's Touring. And he took us to a little spot at the last bit, and he showed us a plant. And he said there are many plants that when one finds in the Fynbos region, the historic ancient Fynbos region, which are very good at addressing diseases that most people use drugs for. And he said, here is a particular plant that has been very successful against cancer. Now, I don't remember the name of it, but he said he had a researcher from the United States who had been looking into this, and when he got close to proving his point, his funding was cut off, which I found really strange, because if we've got a cure for cancer in a South African indigenous plant, you'd think that there would be people beating down the doors to find it. And he said, this is a botanist, he said, it's the pharmaceutical companies didn't want this professor to keep going, which I found extraordinary as being just a member of the public, but I guess it supports your thesis.
Yeah. So let's give you the best example. The best example is the cholesterol theory, that cholesterol causes heart disease, and therefore you must eat a plant-based, low-fat diet, and you must not eat animal fats. That is based on associational data. And when they try, association data means that if you find in a population, you find the people with high cholesterol have more heart disease, or in that country, because that's been, but the associations have been disproven repeatedly. But the point, the real point is that we don't want that. We want randomized controlled trials where we put people on a different diet and we see what the outcome is. And one of the people who was involved in my trial on the prosecution side was a professor, Jacques Rousseau. He was in the background. And he came from Stellenbosch, and I knew him, and I worked with him in the 1980s. And he, for some reason, he left South Africa, he goes to America, and he's appointed head of the biggest diet trial in history. And it's called the Women's Health Initiative. And it was $700 million. And all it showed was that if you followed the diet and you had heart disease, you did much worse. you're at 67% increased risk of progression of your disease if you ate his healthy, prudent, low-fat diet. You got worse. And that was the population that's most at risk. If you've already got heart disease and you put on something that makes it worse, you'll detect it in that group. And they tried to hide the data. And I, because I knew he was involved and he was used by UCT to debate with me, and you can see actually see it on the internet. So we had this debate, which was completely biased against me. It was astonishing how they managed to rig the debate. But anyway, so I became very interested, and then I discovered this thing that they'd hidden the facts that the intervention proved that changing the diet made things worse, not better. So that's the background. Now, what does that mean? Every cardiologist in the world is taught that cholesterol causes heart disease and statins prevent it. And I can promise you, I can assure you that all the evidence, when they look at the statin effect, it is tiny, if at all. And then it's got all these other complications. But the point is, it has essentially minimal effect on your future risk of heart attack. And some studies show that you'll live another 3 or 4 days if you take high-dose statins for 5 or 6 years. So the effects are minimal. But what's happened is that there's been no research on what might prevent heart disease progressing. None at all. Because the pharmaceutical industry says, well, why would we want to do that research? Because we know cholesterol is the problem, and we know statins lower your cholesterol, and therefore they prevent the problem. So instead of doing the research to find out what the real answers are, that's shut down. And again, it comes back to what science is about. Science is about disproof, not proof, disproof. So we need research to show that these things don't work, not that they do work. And no one's prepared to do that. Or when they get a result which suggests that they don't work, they still say, well, actually, they are working. So that's the bad part of science. Yeah.
You've battled for many years with being a polarizing figure. How can you close that gap? Because on the one hand, you've got what you're showing, as you've explained now, and you've just given us another example. On the other hand, you've got a status quo approach, which says, no, he's completely wrong. In fact, he's a quack, as they tried to take you with the two trials, which you won both of them. And how you must have thought about it a lot. How can you close that gap? How can you open eyes rather than maybe be perceived as poking a stick in their eye?
Because the difference is, I'm a scientist. I'm not a medical practitioner or clinician. That's the difference. The clinicians are not taught to think and question, with respect. You know, you don't go to medical school to learn science. You go to medical school to learn practice. It's purely to teach you, this is what you do. It's a technical training. It's not a scientific training, and that's the problem. And so you can't change it. You can only change it by getting the people who in the system who will teach you to be a scientist, not to be a technician. And that's the problem. There's absolutely no reward for being like me in medicine. Absolutely zero reward. It is, you're just signing your own suicide death certificate if you start questioning. Because the professor at the faculty is controlled by the pharmaceutical industry. And if you for one moment question what he's telling you, then you're out. You're finished. You've got no career. You won't have appointments. You won't get appointed in a hospital. You won't get appointed locally. You won't be able to get a good reference from him. And that's the terrible reality. So I'm not polarizing. I just tell you the truth. These are the facts. And go and look at them. And if you can't see the facts, that's because you have no interest in discovering the truth. I mean, I was debating, I was chatting to a cardiologist the other day, and he has a YouTube video saying diabetes is the biggest cause of heart disease. That's it. So then I said, but now what diet prevents diabetes? So he said, no, there's no diet that can prevent diabetes. I said, there is. There's a high-fat diet. So if you're preventing diabetes with a high-fat diet, why is that making the disease worse? And it just poof, poof, the shutters came down. Because that he can't go down that route, because then he might have to question everything he's been taught in his discipline. And that you literally cannot do that. Because if you do that, you're finished. It's the end of your career.
But you weren't. You challenged, I mean, that wonderful book of yours, Challenging Beliefs, had a look at everything that you believed before, and you challenged them and changed them. It's through history, and I'm getting back to your large library, through history. Who's like you? Who do you draw inspiration from?
Yeah. Like Semmelweis was one of the guys who questioned washing your hands. He realized, I mean, he was a genius, and he realized that the surgeons, the obstetricians who were delivering the babies were also doing the autopsies on the mothers who died from childbed fever. And he realized they must be transferring something from the autopsy room back because they weren't washing their hands. And he eventually went mad because he couldn't convince anyone it was true. He did have a few problems. He didn't write enough. And that's what I do. I speak and write a lot. And that's so people have there's a legacy that people can see what I've said over the years. Semmelweis is obviously one. And there's a lot of people in the low carb group who have been astonishing. So I definitely follow them on Twitter. I think that Twitter's really kept one going, because then you see all these other people who agree with you and who are in high positions. Robert Kennedy is a great example of someone who wants to express the truth. I'm thinking, well, Nina Teicholz, she was one of my expert witnesses, and she wrote the book, The Big Fat Surprise, which came out about a few weeks before I was charged. And when it came out, I mean, I just cried, because I said, here's the evidence I'm looking for and I've been trying to explain. So there's a small group of us who are very, very close, and people who helped me in my trial that keep me inspired.
And your books, are they still selling?
I think that the Challenging Beliefs no longer is selling. But the one that is the original Banting book, The Real Meal Revolution, is still going strong. Even now, it's 12 years later. I'm rewriting Law of Running at this very moment and just loving it, because it's all come together in a way that I could never have predicted. And everything I read, it just says, well, there you are. It just confirms what you've been saying. So I'm busy writing that. And then I'm doing the science as well. You know, one of the opportunity arises. I was approached in 2017 by a South African graduate from Rondebosch Boys High School, who's now in America. And he said, Prof, would you like to do some studies with us on low-carb diets? And we started 7 years ago, and we finally did the definitive trial. It took us 7 years, and we did the definitive trial. And it disproved what they've been saying, and it proved that we're more correct than they are. And that would never have happened if I hadn't had the trial and been thrown out. I would never have had this opportunity. And that then I led to this other article, which is the 100-page article, which is going to be revolutionary. And the profession, the nutritionists, nutrition dietitians are going to have to look at that and say, oh my gosh, we're teaching people all the wrong stuff.
Well, there is a big part of me that hopes that there is going to be acceptance of it. But as you were talking about that, there are many challenges to the truth. And I'd love to get your insight on Rob Herzog's favorite drug of choice, which is Ozempic. He is a huge protagonist of Ozempic, and he's looking good. He's lost a lot of weight as a consequence of it.
You should tell him to get off that drug immediately.
Immediately. Why?
Because the long-term consequences are horrendous. Again, it's one of these drugs that becomes like the statins. They promote it long before they've done the clinical trials. But there's a mortality, for example, with that drug, but there are also other problems. And you can never get off the drug because you put on the weight again. And that's, so you won't do it. It's like if you give an athlete steroids and they find that they're much stronger, they never get off the drug because they don't want to go back to what they were. So I can tell you, he should just go and read the literature that's coming out now on the complications of Ozempic. And they're not, it's a disaster. You shouldn't be using the product. You should be using a low-carb diet. The low-carb diet takes effort. They work exactly the same way. The low-carb diet fills you with, you satiates you and takes away your hunger and it takes away your cravings. That's exactly what Ozempic does. It does exactly the same. The physiology is identical, but the problem is Ozempic has a whole range of side effects, which will become apparent. And most people stop taking Ozempic within the first year, and then they put on the weight, the extra weight. So he's caught, unfortunately, in a bad situation. And if I was his doctor, I would get him off the drug and put him on the low carb diet, and be very serious about the low carb diet. And the first thing he has to do is have to get rid of his sugar addiction, because the sugar addiction is the key problem. And now you see, with Ozempic, you can have your sugar addiction and you can take your Ozempic and you can lose weight. But if you don't get rid of the sugar addiction, you can't lose weight on the low-carb diet. So those are the issues. And for many people, I love these stories. I'm shopping yesterday at Woolworths and a guy comes up and he says, "You're Prof Noakes, aren't you?" He said, "Yes." He says, "Look at me. I've lost 40 kilos in the last few months." And he lives, I think, no, he doesn't live in Amanus, but he does the cycling races in the area. And he said, "But I've stuck. I can't lose any more weight. And I'm still 20 kilos overweight." And so I said, "Okay, so what are you eating? Are you eating completely zero carbs?" "You know, I have to have my nachi before I sleep at night, because if I don't have the nachi, I can't sleep." I said, "Okay, what else?" And then it turns out, the rice and the potatoes and the bread. I said, "Yeah, you, unfortunately, you still got the cravings. You still got the addiction. You're not going to lose that 20 kilos unless you get all those addictions controlled." So let's go back. Ozempic is repeating the normal physiology of a low-carb diet, but it's without the effort. And the point about the low-carb diet, once you get rid of the food addiction and the sugar addiction, it's the easiest thing in the world to do, because the food is delicious. It's the most delicious food that you could want to eat. So I really respect Rob's for his political opinions, and I'll read everything he does, and I'll watch your videos with him. But he's got it wrong on this, and he needs to know that that when he stops taking it, the problems will start, and he needs to get off it and wean himself off by going onto the low-carb diet.
You know, something that is that often baffles me is the stories that you've told us and the results of your research. They're pretty clear of how the world works. And even in popular culture, we've been going through the Big Bang Theory again. And in this wonderful comedy, you have two of the key leading characters who work for a pharmaceutical company. And they're forever saying, the side effects are, making a joke of it, that the side effects are X, Y, Z and really terrible. But we tell people differently anyway. And we've had OxyContin, which was also the side effects of that have been horrific. So it's in the popular culture. It's like people really know this, and yet they don't absorb it. They don't buy into it fully. Why do you think that is? Why is it that human beings are not listening to Tim Noakes and continuing to listen to the pharmaceutical interests?
Yeah, because we're brought up to believe that there's a pill that solves all the problems. That's the reality. You know, that's what the culture is all about. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen. That's not the case. By the way, I must just get one book. So just going to get a book quickly. So the one thing that the Noakes Foundation and Nutrition Network did was we produced this textbook. I don't know if you can see
it. Ketogenic. Yep, I can see it with a fried egg on it.
And that's how big it is. And this is the most complete study or book on the low-carb diet. So those are the pages. This is the science. And it proves that this is the most studied diet in history. And it's the most effective diet in history. So that's all you have to do now is go to medical school and give this to the students. And then they will solve many of their problems of chronic disease. So that's what we've done. And by standing up, so the question is, how can an NGO produce this book? Not a medical school. And we've got 60 of the world's leading scientists who do the low-carb diet to contribute. They all contributed for nothing. No, there wasn't a cent past their hands because they believe so strongly in it. And all of us benefited from the diet. Every single one of us was eating that way, having ill health problems. We all changed and we devoted to try and change the world by promoting this diet. So it literally isn't the pills, it's the diet. And that's what we got to get that message out.
And you say we, because that was also your own story.
Exactly right. And literally everything, you look at the authors, every single one of them had the same experience. We were eating this way, we got fat, we got diabetes, we got other illnesses, and we changed, and miraculously within months, we were much better. We'd lost the weight or we're losing the weight and we're reversing our underlying disease. So the evidence is all there. It's all in the science literature, but it's not taught at medical schools. Now, why isn't that not taught at medical schools? And we've been through that, why it's not taught.
We know that change is a little bit like the bell curve in that there are the early adopters and the bulk of people take quite a lot longer. In your whole mission, your nutrition mission, are you starting to move along that bell curve yet?
Oh yes, no, we definitely are. I mean, we've moved dramatically. When you think, if you go back 10 or 15 years, no one was talking about this diet, but now everyone knows, as you said in the introduction, everyone knows that if you want to lose weight, you've got to go low carbs. But it's still difficult because they don't get over the sugar addiction. That's what we have to get over. And now our Noakes Foundation is pushing very strongly for people realizing that sugar is the gateway drug, that you start on sugar, then you go to alcohol or cigarettes or whatever. And it's the gateway drug. And And your brain is changed. If you've got a food addiction, your brain is changed. And unless you change your brain back by getting rid of all the influences, the dietary influences, you're never going to be healthy in the long term.
Once again, it's been such a privilege talking with you, Tim. I know that the Biz News tribe just love you, and it's very hard to have a balanced conversation with you coming from where we're coming from, because we know each other so well, and you certainly have pointed me in so many good directions, and to the tribe as well. And thank you for the work that you do. And once again, thanks for spending an hour with us this morning. We look forward to repeating this, in another 2 years' time, hopefully not that long, but more strength to your elbow. And we look forward to that 100-pager. That, as you say, will be revolutionary. Professor Tim Noakes is the founder of the Noakes Foundation, and I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.